Good day all, and welcome to DS&I Deconstructs. We want to thank you for joining us as we bring together the most prestigious minds in the world to discuss the importance of land trust and all the different variables of our lives that will be affected by it in the coming future. My name is John Smith, and I am the Executive Director of the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative. We are a membership organization that was formed in 1984, and we do community-based planning and organizing in the Dudley area of Boston. We manage the largest urban community land trust in the country that includes homes, community gardens, parks, and playgrounds. So again, welcome to our second episode. And sadly, Farai is not able to join us today. She's a little bit under the weather. We miss her and wish her a speedy recovery. But today on our second episode, we welcome John Barros to the table. John Barros served as the former executive director of DS&I. Then he went on to be the chief of economic development for the city of Boston under Mayor Walsh. Welcome, John.
Hey, thank you, John. Good to be here.
Nice to see you, my friend. So we wanted to start basically, you know, thinking about, as we think about the history of Boston, and start with, you know, you served for a long time as the ED of the DS&I in the creation of the Land Trust and us as an organizing group. I just wanted to kind of think through you. What was your vision for DS&I then? How did you think about building it? And what did you think about was the principal work then? And what do you think is the principal work moving forward of DS&I?
Wow. I see you're not going to start with an easy question, right? Let's just get right to the complexity of it. Right. You know, I started my work at DS&I first as a young resident, right? So at the age of 14, I got involved as a youth member of DS&I and started to do youth organizing in the late 80s. And that was about the same time that we started the Land Trust. The Land Trust has been a part of the work since the very early days of DS&I. And as executive director, I knew that my role was a servant leadership role. So it wasn't necessarily about my vision. Mm-hmm. It was about the neighborhood's vision, the community's vision, all the different stakeholders that we brought together in the community organizing process that yielded a community plan. All right, so we planned together, and that vision was a very clear vision. It was a vision of a healthy, thriving neighborhood that supported strong outcomes for its residents and families.
Right. And that was in response to what was happening, right, in the neighborhood.
That's right. It was in response to a neighborhood that had seen disinvestment, a neighborhood that had the highest crime rates in the city of Boston, the highest asthma rates, the highest lead rates, the highest percentage of waste transfer stations in the region. And so the neighborhood had and continues to deal with a lot of issues, but in a real acute way back then. We were just coming out of the race riots in Boston. We were just building from the defeat of Mel King, but the Mandela movement, right? The question of whether the black and brown community could secede from the city of Boston and build our own city, right? So these were all things that were percolating in the neighborhood. And that was percolating because people felt like the city and the systems had failed us, right? That we needed to take leadership and build a neighborhood that would work for us. And so from there, DS&I came together to create a vehicle that would empower residents to be able to make decisions and make plans for building that kind of neighborhood.
So it's interesting, given the racial history of Boston, and given, you know, you think about like busing and some of the other issues that were happening during that time, how did you get the city and other stakeholders to buy into that vision? And resources and
the only way they bought into the vision was because we were able to pack the room with residents. So this was a power play, right? Okay. This was not a convincing of this is a good thing to do. This was not a, hey, let's figure out how to do this together. This was DS&I organizing and showing, in fact, that this is what the people wanted. And so we would organize, we would run campaigns. We would sometimes stand in streets with signs. And oftentimes trying to get the attention of of our political officials, of city officials. And so it took movement. It took movement building to do that. And so at some point they said, well, that's a lot of people. Mm-hmm. We got to mm-hmm. take them seriously, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, I remember one campaign when Ray Flynn was mayor, and we wanted the city to help us get rid of abandoned vehicles in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. We put Ray Flynn for mayor stickers, this is after he was mayor, on all of the abandoned vehicles, right? And and it called his attention, right? You got to come down here and help us figure this out. But those are the kinds of actions that we had to do to get the attention of those who are in power and those who were making the decisions on the distribution of resources.
Interesting. Core to all of this is the organizing effort.
That's right.
And making that happen.
Yeah. Okay. And I think still core to this, meaning, and I know you can attest to that, still mm-hmm. core to this is the organizing efforts, right? And so if, in fact, DS&I doesn't represent the collective voice of the neighborhood and doesn't have that credibility, then it begins to lose its authenticity. And in the chatter around, it would be like, nah, it doesn't really represent the neighborhood, right? Those are just some professionals or a group of people trying to say what happens. And that's always been a tension,
right?
Right? Does it really represent the neighborhood or is it just a group of people? And so the organizing is ongoing and the re-engagement of voices needs to be ongoing and not allow the neighborhood or the organization to sit on planning that was done then
yeah.
or mm-hmm. vision that was done then. It has to continue to evolve. It has to continue to grow as the neighborhood evolves and the neighborhood grows.
So it's always a rethinking. You know,
right.
You know. Yeah. Because it's interesting to go from radical in 1984 to part of the status quo where folks will come to DS9 and think like, you know, you guys work with the city, you guys work with us, you guys work with, you know, help us do this thing.
Yeah.
That we want to do, because you know if we can kind of gain some legitimacy if we partner with you and if we do those kinds of things. So yeah, there's always that tension.
There's always definitely. That tension, and it's a tension I know I felt as executive director, and I know you feel right, yeah. which is like okay, we've established a process by which we organize, we've institutionalized that process. I mean, you're running an organization with a community elected board of 35. Varying stakeholders that include residents, but also small businesses and organizations and neighborhoods. I mean, you've created an infrastructure for organizing and for neighborhood voice. So people want to partner with you, right? And so you no longer need to put the stickers, on the abandoned cars, or it's yeah. a different day, right? And yet that tension to still push, that tension to still make noise, right? And so there's a balance, and DS&I has a role to play that today is a more mature role than it was back then.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So sitting where you sat at the city, chief of economic development, looking at all these different organizations and businesses, and you know, I know you've dealt with housing, you dealt with environmental issues, you dealt with job creation and all of that. You've seen the city change and develop over the time that you were sitting there. How can we get the city to keep focusing on still sometimes neglecting neighborhoods, neglecting in one sense in terms of some economic development, but gentrifying in the same sense, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So what do you think some of the levers that the city can use?
Yeah, let me say a couple of different things. One is, as chief of economic development, when I sat in that seat, it became ever so clear that the city doesn't hit the ground without neighborhood partners. The city doesn't hit the ground without community partners. And so the city hits best or is most impactful when it has infrastructure in a place for it to distribute services, resources, and partner with someone to do things there, right? I mean, not every neighborhood has a DS&I. That's a challenge,
right?
Right. Not every neighborhood has done a planning process and knows what it wants. That's a challenge, right? And so when you have a neighborhood with an infrastructure to engage people in a transparent process, have meetings, make decisions together, then the city shows up and it has an infrastructure that it can engage. When city officials look at an area and say, ooh, we got to kind of organize that area so we know what's going on. That is a tricky position for a city to play.
Okay.
Right. And so as chief of economic development, I always found it, and I partnered with DS&I, John, on the DS&I, you know, vision for the neighborhood, right? And it was easy for me as an official to do that because I knew the neighborhood had a plan. I knew the neighborhood had, and I knew as an official, I can come in and say, what does the neighborhood want to see? And it's really clear. Here's what the neighborhood wants to see. Okay, here's what the city's going to do to help implement the neighborhood's plan. And in fact, I was honored to be able to partner with DS&I as chief of economic development to implement the community plan. Not come in and plan for the community. Not come in and tell the community, here's what I think the community should do. And that's a privilege to have a neighborhood in your city and have certain neighborhoods that are ready to work with city officials because they've run a community-led, community-wide planning effort that is clear about what the community wants to see and what the vision is.
So there's room for models of folks that function in a way DS&I function to sort of plan out their communities, that look at workforce development, that look at the changing nature of it, and also the development of CLTs.
Right.
You know, are you thinking, again, based on the housing crisis and affordable housing in Boston, thinking that CLTs continue to be, do you see that as still an innovative model in the city for creating housing?
Absolutely. I mean, the CLT is an important model that recognizes that cities are ever changing, neighborhoods are ever changing, and in a time where cities are under pressure because people are coming to cities, so the population is growing in our cities, and the housing stock is not growing at the same time because there's more people coming. So more people want to buy these homes that we have here, right? As much as building as we're doing, we're not building enough given the amount of people. So that's just pressure on the housing. So the question then are cities going to be built only for the people who can buy expensive mm-hmm. housing? Or are we going to build cities for the working class? Are we going to build city for the poor families in our cities? And so the community land trust ends up being an incredibly strategic and important vehicle to make sure that we have affordable housing for all of our families at all income levels that are in perpetuity, so outlive urban cycles, and that we have uses that can't pay for expensive rent. Because that's the other thing. On the commercial side, I mean, we're sitting in an amazing studio here built by the record company in Roxbury, which is an amazing studio. But somebody had to have made a decision that they're going to allow a studio to sit in a neighborhood that's changing. Because what people are going to be able to pay for rent in this neighborhood is going to change and become more expensive. So that's where the land trust comes in and allows us to keep uses that would have been too cheap or not be able to pay rents when the real estate gets more expensive, keep them in our neighborhoods, keep them in our cities, and keep those uses around because those uses are important. You know, as you know, we worked very hard in Upham's Corner to think about how we build affordable space for cultural uses and artists. That's one huge example, right?
Which is still lacking in the city.
That's right. Not only is it lacking, it's getting pushed out. It's
pushed out.
Yeah. Right? And so we have to quickly ramp up our ability to build more affordable and accessible cultural spaces and artist spaces because we need that in our society. We need that in our community. It's what makes us a vibrant community. It's what makes us a place to have difficult conversations about race and about income and about justice or injustices. And so we have to have the land trust model available so we can do that even though the land is becoming more and more expensive.
Interesting, yeah, because interesting that you talk about the cultural pieces because I think when you look at the city now, what's being built is sort of to accommodate the life sciences, the R&D, and there's this cultural piece that kind of gets pushed out or... You know, so we talk about housing, and then the focus is on building these almost like smaller cities that within the city that are kind of devoted to, you know, lab space and technical stuff and all that. As those folks come in, though, I think about the tensions with land trust that one, as you well know, one of the tensions is financing for land trust, you know, and accessing, you know, sufficient and flexible types of financing. How do you see, how does that go hand in hand with all the development that's happening? So you have the development companies that are coming in, the philanthropic community, and other stakeholders. How can we, these organizations that are working on housing, kind of use them, work with them to help us build more of this affordable housing?
Yeah, no, great question. It's, you're right. In order for the land trust to be a viable model, it needs capital, right? And it needs flexible financing. There are three sources, I think, for that have to show up. One is the city. So government has to recognize the importance of the land trust in how the city grows so that we can preserve access, so we can preserve affordability. The second is philanthropy, which typically likes funding programming and doesn't like funding, as you know, right? Yeah. Doesn't like funding capital for buildings, doesn't like funding capital for acquisition, et cetera, right? And so how does philanthropy get into the conversation and begin to understand that the programming that they're funding for the people that they want to impact, it, you know, won't be relevant if the people can't be here, right? If the people can't be involved in this city, can't stay in this city, the program is not going to be available for them because people are going to be gone.
Right.
The third group of folks that who need to be involved is the private sector, right? So developers who are coming in need to partner with land trusts and other organizations and community so that the increase in value in real estate is shared both in terms of private and public good. Right, that the land trust is partnering to build things, and that we are able through the land trust to capture a certain wealth creation on behalf of the community and public good, right? And so I think those all three need to partner in a way that allows us to grow a city that's more equitable and a city that's more just.
You know, private organizations don't have the same tensions in a sense as government, right?
Right.
They don't necessarily have to answer to a specific community and have to go, well, we'll just sort of give them what they want. So how do you see community organizing impacting those kinds of organizations as we think about, you know, place-based transformation, right? So they're coming in. Do you see community organizing still being effective to put some pressure on private organizations to really make some change?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think community organizing needs to continue to put pressure on government and continue to put pressure on the private sector to make the change. But, you know, community organizing, and so often people would ask for certain things, and then the need to answer those requests are not designed with community.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So oftentimes people ask for community benefits, right? And then developers go out and figure it out, right? That people ask for, the community needs to continue to partner.
To be engaged in that community benefit conversation.
To be partners, yeah. To be owners of those kinds of benefits. And so that's a different capacity, right? That's what a tool like the Land Trust allows communities to have. It allows them to be partner ready as physical development is happening. As the city is looking to hit the ground, maybe with some resources to make sure, in fact, that the city is growing in a certain way, the community land trust gives you a vehicle, you know, that allows you to be there and do land stewardship, right, in partnership, make sure that things are accessible, that they are affordable. Those vehicles are critical for communities to continue to partner and not just put pressure, not just organize. Organize is critical. It's essential. You have to do it. You've got to be part of the conversation. Partnership takes a different level of or a different type of capacity to engage.
What do you think are the most important parts of a community planning process? As folks who are listening to this thinking, okay, you know, John sort of eloquently said our communities need to do more planning. What do you think are the most important parts of that process in terms of community planning?
Yeah, you know, the most important part of community planning is to, in fact, have a transparent process that allows everyone to engage, right? People who want to engage. Not everybody's going to engage, right? But have you laid out a process where people are like, oh, okay, everybody who wants to engage can engage here, right? They have translation. And so, you know, those who don't speak English, you know, can engage. They have, it's ADA accessible. They have food for people who know that they got to take up, they got to have this meeting at dinner time, right? That they have, that we've done the appropriate outreach and people can engage at the meetings. They can send letters. They can, you know, place phone calls. They can engage online. When you begin to design a process and implement a process for full engagement, people take that process very seriously. They're like, okay, all right, that's good planning. Right. That is a good way to make sure that people's voices were heard. Then that plan becomes credible because it's authentic. The community did engage. And let me say, it's not just about process. Then you got to say, well, did people show up? Did people participate? And if people didn't, you're going to need some more meetings. You're going to need to rethink it. Right. So sometimes you're like, oh, we did everything and people still didn't show up. Well, then we didn't do everything enough. Right. It was the wrong day. It was the wrong distribution, whatever. Right. You got to do it where people, in fact, are and have participated. That's what is most important in a community planning process. And not everybody's voice is going to show up in the same way.
Right.
Right. But did you take it into account? Right. Is the process and was the decision making process clear enough for everybody so that people saw what they said and their input was valued and in fact showed up in the final product. Those are all important elements.
Yeah, I see the challenge too now is, you know, you have discussions with people and they're like, John, you know, especially in the city because of all the corporate interests, because of the status quo, and it's like, it's hard to subvert a certain kind of thinking. You know, it's hard to change, you know, if folks want to put up a building there, they'll put up a building there. They'll battle and they'll, you know, we'll organize, but the building will still go up. And they sort of see that the status quo infrastructure is stronger than the infrastructure in terms of organizing and changing things. And I think sometimes people lose hope around that, right? So I guess I'm asking, in terms of policy responses or things that can be innovative, yes, we have to continue to organize, but are there things that you're thinking that are the things folks should be thinking about that we can do to help the city really move in a more equitable manner?
Yeah, I mean, then you get into the question of not every organizing school model approach strategy is the same.
Okay.
So then the question is, what's your organizing strategy? What's your organizing model? Is our organizing effective, not effective? I mean, DS&I has a different organizing model than other schools. I mean, so let's, you know, DS&I's organizing is built on a shared vision. DS&I's organizing is built on collaboration and partnership. DS&I's organizing is not built on trying to find a target and the with the most power in a power analysis, and then going after that power in that way. No, the most important thing for DS&I is not targeting power. The most important thing of DS&I is targeting the outcome for vision for our neighborhood. Now we need to go amass power to get that. And so you might need to go talk to the power brokers and shift the power dynamic, right, but always with an eye towards the vision. So when you arrive at a place where that where the target is willing to work with you, you're working with them towards that vision, right? And it's not always about the combative nature of organizing. So there are different schools of organizing. I think that's important. Mm-hmm. And is your organizing effective or not is a question we should always be asking, right? Is are we getting what we need for the people, or are we doing this almost ceremonially? Right. I'm going to hold up a protest sign because I'm going to hold up a protest because that's what we do. What's that getting you? Right? Right. So the question is, let's come back. Let's debrief and let's figure out, in fact, if the work we're doing is yielding something for the people we are doing it for. And I think that's a hard time. That's a hard thing sometimes for us to do, but it's essential.
Always with the focus on the people.
Always with the focus on the people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Can you, are you adding impact? Or, I mean, I remember going to meetings where people would, you know, talk about like, let's be careful so that the third sector or the nonprofits working in our community aren't just working in our community and pimping our community. Right. Right. The notion that we have professionals working for nonprofits getting paid. Right. But they're not asking the question is this impacting the people?
Yeah.
Are you doing something that is making it better for people in our neighborhood that is yielding better outcomes? That's the real question, not whether you're getting paid to ceremonially
show up.
Yeah, show up, yeah. Hold up a sign.
Thought partner.
Yeah, we'll throw, do yeah, exactly, right? You know, we could do that all day.
Right.
But if it's not yielding anything, you got to really put that into question. We got to change the work and what we're doing.
Yeah, because it's really about the impact on the ground.
That's right.
And how people live their life and where they live, how they live, whether they have access to things.
Yeah.
The last question, John, for today. You know, as you think about, you know, Boston as it keeps changing, you know, we know the challenges. They're out there. The wealth gap, huge wealth gap still exists. What does an equitable Boston look like 5-10 years down the road? What you say, if someone says, what is that? What does the city look like? What are all the elements of that for you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, an equitable Boston is a Boston where you have more. You got to get rid of some of the disparities, right? So if you don't have the right outcomes, even though you're trying hard, or you have the right process, and you might have the right people in seats, if you don't have the right outcomes, right? If we can't bridge this wealth gap, if we can't bridge the income gap, if we can't bridge the disparity in neighborhood services and businesses and jobs in neighborhoods, then we're not a more equitable city. We got to make sure that we are eliminating the environmental injustices that exist in our neighborhoods and don't exist in others. We've got to make sure we've dealt with and eliminated the gap in crime and crime levels and crime occurrences in certain neighborhoods. So there are clear, I think, indicators out there for whether we are going to be moving towards a more equitable city or not. But these things, the outcomes need to be different for people in neighborhoods like the neighborhood that I live in, for us to be moving towards a more equitable city.
Neighborhoods are changing, though.
The neighborhoods are changing. The neighborhoods are changing. So one of the indicators, right, has to be, do we have enough affordable housing and options, right? Can people stay? That has to be an indicator, right? And if we're not building enough affordable housing, enough affordable small business space, enough affordable cultural and artist space, then we're losing. That's not an equitable city. That's a city that, in fact, continues to be more and more inequitable.
Inequitable.
That's right.
So, John, what is the consistent demands of the community, and what's been the sort of status quo pushback? Again, from sitting at your seat at DS&I to becoming the Chief of Economic Development, what have you seen in terms of the consistent demands of folks in the community, some of the status quo pushback to that?
You know, I think consistently the community has asked for equitable distribution of opportunities. Right, whether it's jobs, business development, capital, you know, the community's asked for, you know, when we're as the city is developing, we want to be part of it. As jobs are being created, we want to have access to them. As you know, green areas, parks, gardens, playgrounds are being built, we want them in our neighborhoods as well. Right, as you're thinking about climate change and the impact of climate change and people and we're building more resiliency in the city. We want you to build resiliency in our neighborhood, right? We want quality schools in our neighborhood. I mean, I think the community's asks have been consistent, right? And the pushback, in fact, I think it has been, for me, the pushback is a pushback that is programmatic. Right, we're gonna drop a program. Right, mm-hmm. We're gonna do. We're gonna push hard and transform or the turnaround program for this school. We're gonna do a turnaround initiative for this school. Right, we're gonna do. And it hasn't been. We haven't done enough to address the systemic issues in communities. right? So it's been problematic because it's been programmatic in response, and short term, right? It's been spotty. It's time to address these programs and or these problems in a more systemic long term efforts.
But that's also a shortcoming of the philanthropy, right? There's this whole sense of, we'll fund this for 2 years, we'll fund that for 2 years, we'll pilot this, we'll pilot. And there's never seems to be any long-term thinking or follow through. You know, we want to build things that are permanent, you know, in terms of taking on the systemic issues, but we sort of want to do it by offering temporary aid. In terms of building,
yeah. No, it's you're absolutely right, and nobody knows this better than you in your position. But philanthropy, all of the reports coming out of philanthropy say you need long-term, deep investments to have real outcomes in neighborhoods. Right? If you're gonna attack poverty, you need to really have sustained, long-term, you know, deep investments. A lot of money needs to go in it. You need to work in with very flexible money. But philanthropy does the opposite, right? Philanthropy, and here's a criticism of philanthropy. And so all the folks listening to this, you can call me later and push back, right? But there's a little bit of poor people can't, you know, fix it themselves, right? There's a little bit of those community agencies really don't know what they're doing. There's a little bit of like, you know, John Smith is a good guy, John Barrow is a good guy, but as executive directors, you know, they need our help.
Yeah.
So the philanthropy then becomes prescriptive, yeah. Right? Here's what you need to do. Here's what I want you to do with my money. Here's how quickly I want you to do it. And then I want you to tell me that you did it. And I want you to tell me how many people you did it with, et cetera.
And because I have the outcome, because so I got an answer.
Yeah. But the outcomes are transactional. Right, the outcomes are like, how many people showed up? How many people did you? Because the presumption there is that the foundation knows how to do it. So if you just follow this, and if you report back the outcomes of that you did it, I don't need to know. So they're not reporting. You can't report back the impact because the money wasn't enough and the time wasn't long enough, right? So it's very presumptuous of them to think they know the strategies, and that they're gonna, and if you follow this script, you will have the impact that you're trying to get to, and it just hasn't proven to be true. Philanthropy's own reports have shown, in fact, that more flexible money over a longer period of time in the hands of people who are doing the work, in the hands of community, in fact, yields better outcomes. But they don't go to that. They typically go to control, and they typically go to accountability in the short term.
Yeah, I like that framing of the transactional, and then thinking about how can policy be transformative, right? Mm-hmm. Is there a way that you've seen that policy can be transformative, and that we don't always have to think of everything from this, let me give you this and do this in 2 years. You know, if I give you $10, you got to make sure this happens. You actually really needed to give me $1,000. But,
right. You
know, so then, all right, there's that issue. But then can policy be really transformative for the work that organizations are doing in the city? Should that be a lever that we're using more?
No, absolutely. Right now, when you say, can policy be transformative? The answer is yes, but it's policies at all level, okay. Right? So philanthropic policy needs to rethink about whether it can trust its partners on the ground, right, to have more flexible funding for a longer period of time and be on a journey together, right, and then allow people to be part of the design of solutions. That's a different policy stance, right? Now, oftentimes, too, policies in cities or city government needs to be, I mean, I think about, you know, things like, you know, the policies of DTA and assistance to poor families that actually restrict families from growing wealth.
Yeah.
I mean, that is how do you have a poverty assistance program that prescribes poverty?
Right.
So in order for you to get assistance, you can't do better. I mean, there's something perverted about that, right? And so how do then we begin to look at policies that are failing our families and change those policies and still have the level of adequate accountability, still have the level of transparency that we need? I get it. The government doesn't want people who don't need the assistance to have the assistance. But there's a cliff effect, right? There's a cliff effect because now I can't improve myself enough because the gap between the ceiling that you've set on this program and what it takes for me to be independent is too big, mm-hmm. right? And so policy is important. Policy can absolutely get us the kind of impact we need, but policy needs to be reviewed. Policy needs to be reformed. We need to think if the way we're doing things hasn't gotten us what we need, then we need to change that policy. Let's look at public housing. Is public housing getting us the impact or the outcomes that we need? How many families in public housing have been in public housing and then are able to get out of public housing and live in market rate housing? So if that's not the trajectory, mm-hmm. then okay, fine. But if that's the trajectory, then we're not getting that outcome, then we need to review the policies around public housing.
What would be an innovative idea around public housing? Innovative policy idea.
Innovative policy idea about public housing.
I'm picking your brain because I know you ran for mayor and you thought about some of this.
Hey, look, yeah. Every public housing child needs to be on track to position themselves for a better life, right? If this is because we have too many families that have been generationally kept in public housing. So my child, if I'm a public housing family, what the city should do for my child is make sure that they have free quality schooling all the way through maybe their master's, right? Okay. That is a good investment to make sure that our public housing is providing a ramp into the middle class, right? And so that the next generation doesn't need public housing. And the economic benefits are clear. And the research can be done longitudinally to show, in fact, that the city would make more money by having a productive resident than it would have by having a resident that you got to continue to subsidize in public housing. That family would be better off. The kid's future would be, I mean, everything, right? So why not then invest in that way? Why not create policies that allow us to, and I've said we need to move to a free higher ed system. And talked about a system where we would do that, and under the administration as chief of economic development, we started that by having a free community college system in Boston, and I think we can get to the 4-year degree, and I think we can get to the master's degree, and we need to do that. In fact, if we're serious about human development, and if we're serious about advancement and upward mobility,
also starts to touch on breaking down this wealth gap.
That's right.
That we have here, right? Yeah. Which has been persistent. And I guess part of the issue for me is, you know, as I sit in this chair about, you know, you're right, I think, from the sense of we're always developing programs. But sort of long term, what do you think are some of the most important elements in tackling this wealth gap, closing it, eliminating it, however we want to frame it?
Right. Yeah. Education needs to be accessible. Now, we've already just talked about the importance of getting people access to affordable quality education. And when I say that, it's not just about the higher ed system. It's also about workforce development, right? And making sure people have the skills that they need to compete in today's economy. That needs to be there. It starts with pre-K, right? And moves all the way through career. The other thing that needs to happen, though, is we need to have access to capital. And we need to have access to capital that's not more expensive than our counterparts, right? So one of the things in the Federal Reserve of Boston study that shows that a white family in Boston has a median net worth of $247,000 and a black family in Boston has a median net worth of $8, right? That study also showed that some of the disparities were found in the percentage of equity that the white families had in their homes versus black and brown families, but also the percentage of interest rate that black and brown families were paying versus white families. So white families were paying lower interest rates and black and brown families were paying higher interest rates. That inequity, that difference makes it that money. And in fact, when you look at debt and the cost of debt for mm-hmm. black and brown families, it is more expensive in it to have debt than it is for a white family. We have to eradicate that. We can't have that. When you look at business ownership, the black and brown business owners, women business owners, frankly, too, have a harder time accessing capital than their white counterparts, particularly their white male counterparts. Those are the kinds of systemic inequities that we have to address. I believe if we made capital available, that we would in fact move the wealth gap dramatically. Because we know that most of it is found in real estate equity, and the other part of it is found in business mm-hmm. in business wealth generation.
Are those types of issues worth organizing around?
Oh, absolutely.
Do you think organizing can absolutely. Have an impact?
Yeah, and those types of issues are worth organizing at all levels.
All levels.
Right. So those in the private sector need to organize around it because our economy is healthier when everyone is doing better.
What would be their impetus, though?
Because we all gain, right? Having an economy, we would all have a stronger economy. We'd all have a stronger cities, have stronger communities if everyone was doing better, right? There's a collective benefit. I mean, people usually look at this through an individualistic lens of helping this family or helping that family. But when you help a family do better, then that family is more productive and our GDP increases, right? For the entire country, for the entire city. Right. And we are more productive and we can actually fulfill more jobs and do more and be more innovative. And so there's a bigger tax base because of that. There are more jobs because of that, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, you know, economists have shown this time after time after time. The best way to help all of us move forward is to, in fact, help all of us
move forward. John, I want to thank you for your time, taking time out. You're really busy. It's good to see you. And thank you for, you know, participating with us in DS&I Deconstructs.
Thanks, John. I want to appreciate your leadership and all that you do. This has been a great conversation.
Thank you, John. Take care.